Good evening, everyone. This week's Parshas, Parshas Nasai, Tav Shinayin Tes, and we will begin, not at the beginning of the Parsha, but we will begin on page 752. Page 752. This is Perek Hey, Pasuk Tes, chapter 5, verse 9. So the Pasuk reads, V'chal Teruma, and any separation, V'chal Kotche B'nei Yisrael, of all the holies of the Jewish people, Asher Krivu LaKohen, that they shall bring to the Kohen, Lo Yiyet shall be to him. That's what the Pasuk reads. And every portion from any of the holies that the children of Israel bring to the Kohen shall be his. So Rashi tells us, what are we referring to exactly here? When we talk about any separation of the holies of the B'nai Yisrael that they bring to the Kohen will be hers. It'll be his. What is this referring to? So Rashi brings down, Amar Rabbi Yishmael said, V'chi teruma ma'akriven la'kohen. It would seem that the assumption from the word v'chol teruma, any separation, which is the word that we use for the separation from the grain to the Kohen, we would think that this word truma is referring to that. It's referring to what we give to the Kohen, typically from the grain. But on that, the question is, v'chi teruma machzirin la'kohen? The Pasuk says, any truma that they will bring to the Kohen. You don't bring truma to the Kohen. The Kohen comes around to everybody, and he picks it up. So what are we referring to? The answer is Eilah HaBikurim. It's referring to the Bikurim, the first fruits. Shenam Rabbahem Tavi Beis Hashem Elokecha. That there the Torah says, you bring it to the house of Hashem your God. V'ne Yodea Mayase Bahem. The Torah only says, bring it to the house of God. What do you do with it afterwards? The answer is Talmud Leimar. So that's what this Pasuk is coming to teach. L'Kohen Lo Yiyeh. What you are bringing to the Kohen, the separation bringing to the Kohen, the first fruits that you separate for the Kohen, to bring to the Beis HaMikdash, lo yiyah, that will be his. Meaning we know that that by Bikurim, you bring it, you give it to the Kohen, the Kohen puts it down by the altar, you make your declaration, what happens to it afterwards? The answer is, lo yiyah, it goes to him. Ba kasevelim et ka'ala Bikurim, shu nitnin l'kohen. This passage is teaching us that when it comes to the Bikurim, they are given to the Kohen. Not just given to the Kohen to take, but actually, eventually, it belongs to him. So that's the first part of it. That's what this Pasuk is saying. That any separation that's brought to the Kohen, for instance, the Bikurim, lo yiyeh, they will be to him, they'll be to the Kohen. The Kohen, it's the Kohen's property. He gets those fruits. Next Pasuk. The Ish es Kadashav, and a man, when it comes to his holies, to his holy things, lo yiyu, they shall be to him. Ish asher yitein la Kohen. What a man gives to the Kohen, lo yiyah shall be his. So what is this Pasuk talking about? So Rashi tells us, the first part of the Pasuk that says, a man, his holy objects will be to him. Being that we know that we have obligations to separate from our grain for the Kohen, for the Leviim. I might think they can come and forcefully take it. The Kohen knocks on your door and he says, you know, he comes by and he says, hand over your truma. Maybe you have no choice. Talmud Loimar, and that the Pasuk teaches us, V'ish es kadashav lo yiyu. A man, his holy things will be to him. The holy things are still yours to a degree. Magid shetoivas hana'as in labaylim. It teaches us that basically the owner, although he can't keep this grain, he's got to give a portion to the Kohen, got to give a portion to the Levi, it's up to him to whom he wants to give to. If the Kohen knocks on the door and he says, can I have your truma? You can say no. You got to eventually give it to a Kohen, but it's up to you which Kohen to give it to. So the Pasuk is saying, V'ish es kadashav, a man, his holy objects, referring to the truma and the miser that he gives away, lo yiyu, they'll be to him. They are his to the point that he is the one who can decide who gets it. No one can basically force it away from him. Okay. That's what Rashi tells us is the Pshat, is the simple interpretation, basic interpretation of the Pasuk. Rashi brings out a Gemara, a Medrash, it has a different explanation. and that the Medrash actually is saying, if I think that's saying something else, it's saying, Vish es kadashav lo yiyu, which means to say, Vish es kadashav lo yiyu, Misha ma'akav ma'asreisa ve'ena noisnan. A person has ties that he has to separate. To the Levi, Ma'isr Sheni. Let's say he doesn't separate them. He keeps them for himself. Lo yiyu ma'isris. So then those tithings will be his. Saif Shein Sadeu Aisel Echem Me'asara Shaisa Lemudal Asais. It'll come out that his field will only produce a tenth of what it normally does. So according to the Midrashic interpretation, a man, his holy things, a man who is supposed to be giving away his ma'isris, the tenth, the tithings, and instead he keeps it for himself, lo yiyu, tithings, a tenth will then be to him. He'll only be left with a tenth of the grain that he usually produces. Okay? And then the other part, the rest of the pasuk, ish ashayitein lekohen, means, but a man who does give to the kohen what he's supposed to give, lo yiyu, there will be to him. What will there be to him? Mamon harbe, much riches. So according to the Midrashic interpretation, one half of the pasuk is saying, if you don't give your tithes where they're supposed to go, you'll be left with a tithe of your grain. But if you give to the kohen what you're supposed to give, you'll have plenty. Okay. Now the Chametz Chaim takes this pasuk and adds another homiletical interpretation, and he explains like this: V'ish es kadoshav lo yiyu. A man when it comes to his holy things, a man when it comes to his mitzvahs, and the Torah that he learns and the mitzvahs that he does, lo yiyu, they will be to him. You have those forever. That's what you really own. Lo yiyu, the holy things that you do, lo yiyu, that's what you will be to you. That's what you'll really have. That is something that you're going to have that no one can take away from you. Ish ashayita la kohen lo yiyya, and a man who gives to the kohen, meaning what he gives away to the kohen, lo yiyya, that's really what's his. That's really what remains with him. The idea being that when it comes to the mitzvahs that we do, that's our true possessions. The tzedakah that we give, that's the real money that we have. Because all those are the kinds of things that are ours for eternity, for Olam Haba, no one can take it away. So the Chafetz Chaim, when bringing out this idea, brings it out with a parable. And I think this parable is brought down in the Medrash somewhere, but the parable goes like this. We have a certain person, okay? We'll call him Chaim, okay? Chaim has three people that he knows. Guess their names.
Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov.
No. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Come on, okay? You're close. All right? Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Reuven is his very, very close friend. Very close. Shimon, they're friendly. They're friendly. Not best friends, but they're friendly. And Levi, he knows him, doesn't have much to do, what to do with him. One day, Chaim gets a summons to come to the king. And when you get a summons to come to the king, out of the blue, it's usually not good news that you have to appear before the king. He was very nervous. He was afraid that perhaps someone informed on him. And he was heading for big trouble. So he was quite frightened and very nervous. So he asked Reuven to come with him to the palace. You know, he needed support. Reuven says, nothing doing. Not going. He was shocked. This is his best friend. But he wouldn't go. All right? He says, well, if Reuven doesn't want to go, I'll turn to Shimon. And Shimon says, okay, I'll accompany you up to the palace. I'm not walking in with you. I'm not going that far. I'll take you to the palace. I'll support you up to there. Once you're in front of the king, I'm not going. That's also not too good. So he has no choice. He goes to Levi. Doesn't have big hopes that Levi's going to help him, but you got to give it a shot. He asks Levi to accompany him. Levi says, no problem. I will come with you. I'll come in front of the king with you. I'll be there to support you 100%. And he comes before the king. Levi's with him. Levi advocates on his behalf. He's a character witness on his behalf. And Chaim is saved. That's the parable. What's it a parable to? It's a parable to a person in life. You know, in life, what are our friends? What are our friends in life? So many people say their best friend is their money. Money's the best friend. Money's their best friend. That takes care of everything. Okay? Next comes family. Okay? And after that comes mitzvahs. You know? Mitzvahs. I know some mitzvahs. Yeah. I do some mitzvahs. Okay. Okay. There comes a day after 120 years, you got to stand in front of the king. A big court case. Okay. You know, your best, the ones you thought were your best friends in life, the money and the possessions, nothing. They can't go anywhere with you. Okay. The family takes you to a certain point, take you to the cemetery, right? After that, you can't go any further. What comes with you in front of the king? The Torah and the mitzvahs that you get during life. During life, it's the kind of things that you don't expect to be there for you, maybe. The things that you didn't rely upon as much comes to a certain point of time that they're the ones that come on your behalf. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that comes with you that stays with you forever are the Torah and the mitzvahs that you do. And that's the pasuk when it says, V'ish es kadosha v'lo yiyah. A man, his holy things, the mitzvahs that he does, lo yiyah. That will be to him. That is what he'll truly possess. That is what he'll never lose. And that is what will accompany all the way to the point, to his final, final destination when he has to stand in front of his creator. There's another famous story that's given to bring out this point. Okay? Another story that's given. And the story that's told is, again, you know, every story starts with a king. And he has different officers that are under him. And one of them is a Jew. Okay? A nice from Jew. Okay? And he is one of his officers. And as an officer, he gets involved in different things. And he's successful. He makes a lot of money. The king loves him because he's a fine, upright person. But of course, how does the rest of the story go? The other officers are jealous of him. How could this Jew be so successful? How could you let him get away with it? So they start telling the king, oh, you think this Jew is so successful? You know how he makes all of his money? He's stealing, he's siphoning it off the treasury from the king. You know, he's doing shtick, he's playing games, and he's basically taking his money away from you. That's how he's making so much money. He's not so upright and honest as you think. So the king doesn't want to believe it, but finally they make him so crazy. And he figures, and he calls over the Jewish officer, and he tells him, you know, I really trust you. You're a good guy. But just tell me, how much are you worth? And he tells him an amount. When the king hears this amount, it's way too low. Way too low. Way too low. Like, the king knows that he has more than that. Why is he lying? Why is he saying he has a smaller amount? And the king gets very, very upset because he's obviously lying. And at that point, the king gets so angry that he just orders him to be thrown into jail. And he has to await a trial. And at some point before the trial, the king is just, he's just bewildered. Like, how could this man lie like that? And he calls him into him and he says, how did you lie to me like that? And the Jewish officer says, I didn't lie. You asked me how much am I worth. I told you what I'm really worth. He says, what do you mean? He says, my real worth is not what I own. My real worth is the tzedakah that I give. That's my real worth. I know that's my truest possessions. I know no one can take that away from me. And actually, any time I give tzedakah, I write it in a journal. And in that journal, I know how much am I really worth. Okay? But when it comes to my worldly possessions, no guarantees. Look, one day, all of a sudden, I lost it all. You took it all away from me when you threw me to jail. And the king asked for the journal. He showed him the journal. It was exactly what he said. And at that point, the king let him go, put him back in his position. He was successful again. And that's because the idea is that a person, this person, and this story has been told, I think, with Ibn Ezra, been told with different people. But the idea was, if you said to them, what are you worth? What do you own? What do I own? What's my worth? My worth are the mitzvahs that I do, the tzedakah that I give. That's my worth. Because that's the kind of thing that I can have, and no one can take it away from me. My worldly possessions can go up in smoke in a second. And that's the same idea. Ish es kadosh lo yiyo. It's the holy things that you have, the mitzvahs that you have, the tzedakah that you give. That is lo yiyo. That will be to him. That will be to you. No one can ever take that away from you. All right. Now. The after these psukim starts, the next portion of the Torah, next part of the parsha rather, which deals with a very unfortunate situation of a sota. A sota means a woman who her husband is suspicious of her, that she is not being loyal to him. And he says that he warns her not to go into seclusion with a certain man. He warns her, don't go. And she does it anyway. At that point of time, she becomes forbidden to her husband. And the husband brings her to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash, to basically test that was she actually unfaithful or not. Righteous she was not, because she did not hear her husband's warning. Righteous she was not for going into seclusion with this man. But did she actually commit adultery or not? We have no idea. So the Torah says you bring her to the Beis HaMikdash, and there's this miraculous way of figuring it out. You take the water, you write this portion of the Torah in parchment, you erase the lettering into water, you give it a drink. If she was actually unfaithful, her stomach blows up, her leg falls out, she falls apart. If she did not actually commit adultery, then it says on the contrary, she's in some way, she improves. She can have children. She didn't have children before. It was difficult having children. She'll have children easier. That's just putting things in a nutshell. Now, following this part of the parsha of Sota, comes then the law of the Nazir. The Nazir is a person who makes a vow of Naziris. And Naziris means, when you say you want to be a Nazir, that means no cutting your hair, no drinking wine, and no becoming ritually impure through a dead body. How long does it go for? If you just say, I'm a Nazir, it's a minimum of 30 days. Otherwise, it's as long as you make it. Okay? Now, the Tugmara asks, why are these two discussions went next to each other? Why do you have Saita and then have Nazir? And the Gemara answers, because Kalaroya Saita Bekokula, if you see a sota, meaning the woman who was accused by her husband, in her ruin, that means she did commit adultery and she drank the water and she just she just fell apart. Okay? When you see that, Yazar Asma Minayayin, you should now separate yourself from wine. Wine is something that is intoxicating. It brings out lust. And therefore, if you saw someone actually commit a sin of adultery, you need to go ahead and do something that has to inspire you to do something to protect yourself from ever coming to that. And what would be that? Not drinking wine. Because wine has the power to get you intoxicated, to build up your lust, and that could actually bring you to sin. Now, I'm not getting into that.
No.
Now, what this is an example of you know, when we see something, right? In essence, it's supposed to shake us up, inspire us, and that we should do something to make sure that, you know, we don't come to do the same thing. But we know that different things that we see leave a different mark upon us, right? You see certain things and it leaves a reshim. It leaves a mark on you. It could be a positive mark. It could be a negative mark. It could be an inspiration. It could scare you. Whatever it may be, things that we see make an impression upon us. And things that we see sometimes make an impression upon us that we don't even realize. You know, the more you get used to seeing something, the more it becomes normal to you. And the more it becomes something that you accept as a norm. Which is why it's so important when it comes to children, we have to be very careful about what they see and how we act. So I saw a very interesting story that there was a first grade teacher, and he had a problem that one of his students was stealing. And he realized it because the other children were complaining, their snacks were missing, their pencils were missing, things were missing. And the teacher, you know, had to figure out what's going on. And he also noticed that things in the classroom were missing. Toys were missing, and pencils were missing, and different things were missing in the classroom. So he had to figure out what to do, who it was. So one day, while all the children were out by recess, he walked back into the room, and he found a little boy stealing. He was doing the stealing. And he was very surprised. This was like a very well-behaved child. And he was stealing. And it was very surprising. So basically, he called up the child's parents and told them what happened. The parents said, you know, We also were noticing that items in the house started being missing. Different things were missing in the house. They decided to speak to the child. Okay, when they sat the child down and spoke to him, they figured out what happened. Basically, this child shared a room with his grandmother. Now, her grandmother, her mind was failing, and she was not allowed to have sugar. But because her mind was failing, she didn't really fully grasp or understand. What mattered to her was she wanted, she wanted something sweet, and they weren't letting her have it. So at night, she'd get up, and she'd go into the kitchen and take a candy and put it in her drawer when no one saw. Okay. Now, her daughter knew what she was doing. So while her mother was sleeping, she'd sneak into the room and take the candy out of the drawer. And who saw all of this? Who saw all of this happening? Who saw the grandmother? Who saw the mother? The six-year-old. It was a six-year-old kid. So he sees the grandmother stealing and the mother stealing back. He thought he could steal too. Okay. It's very important that we have to be careful about what children see, what children experience. Rabbi Biederman from Eretz Yisrael. Some of the following idea, very interesting idea. When Hashem gave the Torah to the Jewish people, Hashem told Moshe, "Kosomar lebeis Yaakov v'sagei levnei Yisrael, shall you say to the house of Jacob and tell to the children of Israel." Right? It says, "You shall tell to the house of Yaakov and speak to the children of Israel." Who is Beis Yaakov and who is Bnei Yisrael? Rashi says, Beis Yaakov are the women and Bnei Yisrael are the men. Okay, there was a message delivered to the women about accepting of the Torah. There was a message delivered to the men. So he asks a question, if the men are called Bnei Yisrael, right, then what should the women be called?
Benos
Yisrael. Why are they called the Beis Yaakov? Why not just be called Benos Yisrael, the feminine form? So he answers like this. Now again, he answers like this. Let's say, imagine you have a bad cold, right? You're all congested. You have all the phlegm in your throat. You're a mess. Okay? There's two things you can do. You could either take medication. Right? You could take medication that will clear up your cold. Or you can maybe walk into a room, right? Fill up the room with steam, Fill up the room with steam and go into the room and breathe it in, and that'll clear you up. The way he says it is, I don't know where he's coming from. You go into a heated room with spices and incense. I don't know what exactly that
Vicks.
Okay. Whatever it may be, again, you can take medicine or you could fill the room with something that will, as you breathe it in, it'll clear you up. So Rabbi Biederman said that there's two ways to fight the Yetzirah, to fight the evil inclination. The Torah tells us, Barasi Yetzirah, I created the Yetzirah, Barasi Torah Tavlin, I created Torah as the antidote. The strongest antidote that we have for fighting the evil inclination is Torah study. That's the medicine. The problem is women don't have that medicine. Women don't have the mitzvah of learning Torah. So what's their medicine against the Yetzirah? The answer is, the medicine for a woman against the Yetzirah is the environment of the home that she's raised in. The environment of the home that she's raised in is going to, if it's a home that is full of Torah and mitzvahs and being God-fearing and a house of good character and proper behavior, that's where she gets the antidote. That's where her antidote for the Yetzirah comes from. It comes from the environment that she's going to be part of, the environment that she was, especially the one that she's brought up in, that's the environment that's going to give her the strength to fight the Yetzirah. So therefore, why are the women called the Beis Yaakov, the house of Yaakov? Because for a woman, the best way that she's going to have the ability to fight the Yetzirah, the inclination, is going to be because of the house. It's going to be because of the house that she's raised in. Okay, not to say there aren't women who didn't have that experience and come out very, very strong and very great. But again, the the best antidote for a man has the study of Torah for his antidote. The best antidote for a woman is going to be the environment she grows up in, or the environment that she becomes part of. Okay. Last thing I want to mention tonight is the following. And that is, at the end of the parsha, we have the Nasiim bringing gifts for the inauguration of the Mishkan. And it's brought down that they brought six covered wagons, right? One second. Right, Shesh Eglois Sav. They brought six covered wagons, Ushnei Asar Bakar, and 12 cattle. Okay? Basically, a wagon, there were 12 princes. You've got a wagon for two princes, and 12 oxen from each one. Okay? And they brought it to the Mishkan as a gift to the Mishkan. So the Torah tells us, if you want to look inside, this is page 764. Perek Zayin Pasuk Vav, chapter 7, verse 6. Vayikach Moshe Sa'agolos Vesabokar. Moshe took the wagons and the cattle. And he gave them to the Levites. Two wagons with four oxen. He gave to the children of Gershon according to their work. The tribe of Levi was divided up into three families, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Now Gershon's job, when the Mishkan was taken apart, what they had to carry certain parts. So they were given two wagons with four oxen to carry their parts. Base Arbaha Golis, the other four wagons, Veshmeina Sabakar, and the other eight cattle, Nasan of Merari, he gave to the children of Merari. Kafiya Vaidaisam, according to their work, Yadi Summer Ben Aaron Akayin, in the hands of Isamar, the son of Aaron the Kayin. Okay? So that uses up them all, right? All the wagons are gone. Vilivne Kaslay Nasan, the children of Kas, they didn't get it, he didn't give them anything. Kavaidas Akaida Shalayim, for the work of because the work of holiness was upon them. They carry the Aron. Bakasif Yiso, they carry that on the shoulder. Meaning the things that the B'nai Kohath carried, like the Aron and the other things, they weren't supposed to put them in a wagon. You're talking about the crush from the boards that goes into a wagon. But when the curtains go into a wagon, but the actual holy objects, like the Aron, that they go in a wagon. That they're supposed to carry on their shoulder. And therefore, they didn't get any wagons. And Bakasif Yiso is a halacha, it's a commandment, right? You're not allowed to transport the Aron in a wagon. You got to carry it yourself.
That was the trouble with
David HaMelech, right? David HaMelech, when the Philistines had captured the Aron, and for many years, and the Philistines, Kadosh Baruch Hu punished them, eventually came back to Eretz Yisrael, and it was by a certain family. And eventually David decided to bring it back to Yerushalayim. Bring it back to Yerushalayim. And he commanded that it be put in a wagon, which was a mistake. And as it was in the wagon, the Aron started, looked like it was tipping over. So a man named Uzzah, I believe, put his hand up to stop it from falling. Because he touched it, he was killed. But David HaMelech was held responsible for everything that happened, because if it wouldn't have been in the wagon, none of this would have happened. It was a mistake that he made. He forgot a halacha. So he forgot a halacha, that you're supposed to carry it, not put it in a wagon. And what did David HaMelech do wrong that he should forget a pasuk in Chumash? What did he do that it should be caused that he would forget something? And that, the Gemara says, the problem is that David HaMelech, you said a pasuk in Tehillim, Zemirais Hayuli Chukecha. Your laws are like songs to me. David HaMelech calls the chukim, he calls the mitzvahs of the Torah songs. Hashem was not pleased with the fact that you refer to my Torah as a song. I'll cause you to forget a law that even young school children know. Right? Young school children are supposed to know Chumash. And they should know, they're supposed to know by Kasif Yiso. David HaMelech forgot about it. Why did he forget? Hashem punished him by saying, you refer to my Torah as a song, and therefore I will cause you to forget a law. So first of all, what's the connection? Number one. Number two, isn't there another place where the Torah is called a song? Yeah, it's called Parshas Hazinu. Kisvu lachem es hashira hazais. Right? This shira. The shira is referring to the Torah. So, what's wrong with calling... Now, the word that David HaMelech used was zmiris. That also means song. What's wrong with David HaMelech calling mitzvahs songs, right, when the Torah itself calls itself a song? So the Vilna Gaon says, but you have to really have to notice that David HaMelech called it zmiris. And the Torah calls itself a shira. It's two different words, and it has two different connotations. Zemirais, songs, means you write a song. When you write a song, there's a beginning to the song and there's an end to the song. Okay? Beginning of the song and end to the song. Shira means a spontaneous outburst of song. You become inspired and you just start singing. And there's really no beginning to it and there's no end. There's no point that says, okay, here you stop. Really, it's something that just goes. I mean, eventually's got to stop, you know. You can't go on forever. But basically, a zemer is a song that has boundaries. It has limits. It starts at a point, it ends at a point. Shira is really has no limits. It goes for as long as it can go. That's where David HaMelech made his mistake. He called the mitzvahs of the Torah a zimra. He called them a song. He called them a limited song. A song that has beginning and an end. It's limited. You don't call the Torah a song, a zimra. You don't call it a limited song. David HaMelech called it a song. He was trying to say how much he loved it, how beautiful it was to him. But the problem is he described it in a certain way. He just used the word that means something with a beginning and an end, something with a limit. And you don't describe Torah as something with a limit. Torah is limitless. Torah is infinite. And therefore, when the Torah wants to call itself a song, it uses the word shira. Shira is a song. It's a spontaneous burst of song that just keeps going till it can't go any longer. There's no established limit to it. Well, David HaMelech, because he called Torah Zimra, which has an established limit, Hashem said, I'm going to limit you. I'm going to limit your knowledge. And even something that school children do know, you're going to forget. But the whole point was, now it's interesting, because this pasuk is a pasuk in Tehillim. Zmiris Hayu L'Chikach is a pasuk in Tehillim. Like, it wasn't taken out of Tehillim because of this. Because, of course, David HaMelech meant it as a praise of how he felt about mitzvahs. But the point is, he used the word that has a connotation of a limit. It's a limited song. It's got a beginning, it's got an end. It has a point of ending. When it comes to Torah, you cannot call Torah something that has an end, because Torah is infinite.
Wasn't there something?